This is Radio Equalshock with your host, Alex Smith.
America is threatening allies and abandoning international aid. In response, defense spending is going up in countries like Germany, the UK, and Canada. As climate science is gutted in the United States, countries around the world realize their dependence on everything from U.S. satellites to databases. Will global science take a hit? Or can the rest of the world carry the burden? Will climate defense spending go up too? We start with America's staunch military and scientific ally in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia. Our guest is one of the most experienced climate scientists in that country. Dr. David Karoly retired from his post as chief scientist at CSIRO and leader of the Earth Systems and Climate Change Hub. He is now an emeritus professor at the University of Melbourne and a counselor on the Climate Council of Australia. From Melbourne, David Karoly, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Happy to join you and to be available to your listeners. It's a great opportunity. I think it's now more than a decade since I was on Echo Shock, and life has changed for me, and life has changed around the world as global temperatures have continued to increase since 2013.
Yes, we've had 10 years of warming since we spoke in 2013, and it hasn't been good, not here and not there in Australia. Do parts of Australian climate science depend on American data machines and institutions that may no longer be available?
Look, as far as I know, the data sets that Australia uses are the sorts of internationally shared weather data that are provided by, for instance, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which are day-to-day weather observations as well as sea surface temperature observations that are fed into Australia's National Weather Service, which is not called the National Weather Service, which is called the Bureau of Meteorology. And it takes in the daily data sets as well as satellite data sets, also from NOAA, as part of its Southern Hemisphere and global weather analysis systems and its weather forecast system. So those data are still available, as far as I'm aware, but it's unclear whether the weather data will continue to be available from NOAA. It is an important component of the NOAA data sets that feed into Australia and feed into every other country around the world. And it is certainly possible, as part of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, that the United States or DOGE or the President decides this data has value and needs to be sold to other countries around the world, but that is against the requirements of the World Meteorological Organization, which encourages and requires the provision of real-time weather data for free to be shared between all countries around the world.
Do you think Australia should try to become more self-sufficient in science, like maybe launching Australian satellites, or would you form new alliances with European agencies like Copernicus?
Yeah, that's a really important and good question. Australia has been involved in research on launching what are essentially low-orbit satellites that collect data sets in terms of observing data sets over the surface. They aren't the polar orbiting weather observing satellites or even the geostationary satellites that are essentially launched by NASA. But there are now Chinese geostationary satellites, Japanese geostationary satellites, as well as weather satellites that are being launched by other countries, including India, and even, as you said, European satellites that have been launched. And so these sorts of different countries are complementing what used to be the leading role that the United States. Australia does not yet have meteorological satellites or geostationary satellites that are available to be used, but it provides ground stations that collect the data and then provide that back to the United States or back to the other countries, because they often don't have ground stations in the southern hemisphere south of the equator, like where Australia is located. And therefore, Australia does have ground stations for the geostationary satellites and the polar orbiting satellites to feed data back to the United States as the polar orbiting satellites pass over the Australian landmass.
There's been a big burst of climate research funding in China. Relations between Australia and China have been rocky at times, but do you see more scientific cooperation between your countries, maybe to help fill the gap caused by America's abdication in the field?
As yet, I mean, there has been increases in collaboration and cooperation between Australia and China, both in weather research and in climate research. At the, if you like, what I would call organisation or institutional level, the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia has collaborative agreements with the Chinese meteorological agencies. The CSIRO, the major research organisation, government-funded research organisation in Australia, a little bit like, NASA and the National Science Foundation in the United States. That organisation in Australia is called the CSIRO. That's the organisation that I used to work for before I retired. That has collaborative agreements with Chinese research agencies. Those are mainly in the weather and climate space, but not really in what I would describe as the defence industries space, because there is concerns between or around expansion of Chinese interests in the Pacific Ocean region and whether, how would I say, Chinese interests might be potentially threatening to Australian defence security issues, as well as issues of defence and security for Pacific Island nations as well. So that is more of a political consideration. Australia has joined in some defence collaboration with the United States and with the United Kingdom through something called the AUKUS agreement. AUKUS is an acronym, A-U-K-U-S, which is a partnership for Australia to spend an enormously high amount of money on buying submarines for Australia. These are nuclear submarines that only a small fraction of the Australian population wants to have purchased and used in Australia. I'm not a supporter of this AUKUS agreement, and it's still unclear whether the new president of the United States knows about that agreement, because in an interview recently with Australian politicians, he did not know what AUKUS stood for or much about that agreement at all.
Well, maybe that's for the better for now. We'll see. So after a few years of delay, the Australian icebreaker RSV Noina is heading out on its first polar research expedition. There's 60 scientists on board. David, are you excited about that expedition?
Oh, absolutely, because it is critically important to understand the limitations in ocean observations, and particularly under ice observations in the Antarctic region. Because there had been delays in both the melting of sea ice and melting of glaciers. The sea ice decline around Antarctica had been somewhat slower than the rapid decline in sea ice in the Arctic regions. And in the last 3 years, there has been a rapid acceleration of the melting of sea ice or acceleration in the reductions in sea ice around Antarctica. The ocean waters have warmed, and what this means is that there has been an acceleration in the decline of glacier ice and melting of ice below the surface around Antarctica in a number of regions. And this is of concern because there's much greater potential increase in sea level from melting of glacier on ice on land and underwater around Antarctica than the ice in Greenland that also contains substantial reserves of water trapped in the Greenland ice sheet. There's more water trapped in ice in Antarctica and much greater potential with increasing warming and melting of ice from the Antarctic glaciers to add to ongoing sea level.
Yes, the sea level rise could be amazing if these melt, and I get the feeling from what NASA said about the Thwaites Glacier being unstoppable and other reports that I've had that this is in process, and it's unlikely that once these glaciers start to melt that they will stop. And so really isn't science at this point trying to measure how fast is this going to happen? How quickly do we need to prepare? Maybe are coastal cities safe at all?
Well, we know that even with the most recent IPCC assessment, there was what they described as a best estimate of sea level rise to the end of this century, which was still sounds quite modest, of the order of 1 meter of additional sea level rise this century. But they also provided ongoing projections because the melting of ice on land, particularly the Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet, continues way beyond, many hundreds of years beyond the stabilization of global mean temperatures. Even if we reach net zero global emissions, stabilize global temperatures at some level in the future, sea level will continue to rise for many hundreds of years. And so the estimates of sea level rise in 2300, well beyond my lifetime and your lifetime, sea level will continue to rise even after we've stabilized global temperatures for hundreds of years. And if we were to follow what I will describe as the Donald Trump drill baby drill scenario, which is essentially ongoing increases of greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels, then sea level rise associated with the melting of the Antarctic ice sheet alone, even just the West Antarctic ice sheet alone, would lead to more than 10 meters of sea level rise. And we also know that the last, if you like, interglacial period, the last time we had warmer temperatures than we might get in 2100 due to the drill, baby drill scenario, what I will call the, if you like, ongoing greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels, the planet would hit 4 degrees or more of global warming. The continents would hit 6 degrees or more of global warming. Antarctica would hit 6 degrees or more of global warming. The West Antarctic ice sheet would lead to 10 meters of sea level rise. That would be a very different planet. And it's also a planet that no Homo sapiens have experienced. The temperatures that I'm talking about are greater than, more than, at any time over the last 200,000 years.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Getting to the fires, I know your country gets intense fires, sometimes several years in a row, but then that can flip to extreme rains and flooding in parts of the country, as recently. Do you think Australians, and maybe the government, tend to forget about bushfire danger during the in-between years, Or is this danger so burned into the national consciousness after Black Saturday and other mass fire events? What do you think?
The acronym that you used, or maybe it's the metaphor that you used, it's not really a metaphor, the name, Black Saturday. Black Saturday actually was massive bushfires in southern and eastern Australia in 2009. And in fact, major bushfires are associated with El Nino events across affecting Australia, El Nino events in the Pacific Ocean, as many people in the western United States and western Canada are aware of. They have a different impact in Canada. In Australia, we also had even larger fires. In the relatively weak 2019 El Nino event, and that was called the Black Summer bushfires, they were the largest area fires across not only southeast Australia, but also right up the eastern coast. And there were fires in much longer than just the hot season. In summer, the fires started in the spring and continued through the summer. And it was called the Black Summer in 2019-2020, recognizing that the summer in the southern hemisphere occurs between December and February. And we're just literally today, for me, it's just the end of the summer, and we have had another very hot summer this year across Australia with significant bushfires. It's not as hot as 2018-19 or 2019-2020. It will be the third hottest summer that we have just experienced. But if we look over a slightly longer period, the winter, spring and summer, the last 9 months, has set a new record high across Australia, consistent with the ongoing impacts of higher greenhouse gas emissions, on the ongoing impacts of greenhouse gas emissions on climate change, not only in Australia but around the planet, remembering that 2024 set a new record high global temperature, more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. We have had this summer in Australia substantial bushfires and grass fires, because what we've experienced had been wet years over the last few years, and that leads to increases in plant growth that has dried out over the last 3 to 6 months, and that means we've had very predominant grass fires and scrub fires, but not as many forest fires. And that is somewhat similar to the experience in Los Angeles a couple of months ago, or about a month ago, where the change from wet conditions over a few years in Southern California, the switch to then a very high temperatures in the fall season and in the winter season in Southern California, where they had an extended dry period and high temperatures, led to extreme fire danger and then massive fires affecting Los Angeles. And I know Canada and Western Canada has also had massive switches between wet years and then followed by dry seasons, which have led to major wildfires in Western Canada and across California as well. And that's being described as, by some people, the climate whiplash that's being accelerated by ongoing global warming.
You know, both of our countries are almost wealthy enough to withstand and rebuild from some of these climate-powered hits like fires or floods, up to a point. But developing countries, they can't afford to deal with the impacts. And there was supposed to be a United Nations fund to help those countries. It's often been promised and always underfunded. Now one of the major funders, the United States, appears to be withdrawing from all that. Should we be concerned?
Well, as you said, depends on whether we are the residents of Canada, the United States, and Australia. And as you said, we are relatively affluent communities, societies in those countries. But there are actually, in Australia, significant homeless people and also indigenous people living in the inland areas in Australia that are absolutely going to be affected by the increases in temperature extremes, increases in fires, and there are the natural ecosystems, the plants, the animals, the birds, the insects are all being affected by these increases in temperature extremes, increases in wildfires across the country. And then we also have to think of the ethical considerations for poorer countries, as you mentioned, countries like Papua New Guinea to the north of Australia, the Pacific Island countries, Africa, Southeast Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan are all being affected by changes in climate, increases in climate extremes, and I will be visiting South Africa for a science-related meeting about the impact of climate change in southern Africa. So I will be using the information and experience from Australia to explain what sorts of things are needed. And yes, it's the resources, not just educational resources, but the infrastructure that is needed to try to address climate change. And what we need to try to do is provide the capabilities to avoid the ongoing manageable impacts. So we've got to manage the unavoidable impacts of climate change, the impacts due to warming that we've experienced already, but we've also got to provide to developing countries the capacity and capabilities to move away from a fossil fuel energy system to a renewable energy system where they harvest the energy from the sun and harvest the energy from the wind to provide renewable energy sources in developing countries as they transition away from a fossil fuel energy system. That is the dominant cause of the problem of global warming.
And, you know, the same people who want to slash climate aid also are worried about mass immigration. But if crops fail or it's just too hot to live, millions of humans may have to move. And then, you know, it would be great if people realized the immigration and climate connection. Do you think people in Australia get that?
It is clear that within Australia, most people are of a similar view that immigration from developing countries is not going to benefit Australia. But you're absolutely right that immigration from developing countries, what are sometimes described as climate refugees, Australia is providing some support for people from developing Pacific Island countries that are losing their land because of sea level rise, their agricultural opportunities, and even their freshwater opportunities. They're losing their country, they're losing their culture, and Australia has said that it will provide some what would be described as land in Australia to allow them to relocate. However, Australia is one of the biggest exporters of coal and fossil gas mined from within Australia. It's selling it overseas to make money. And Australia's exports of fossil fuels make it the third largest exporter of fossil fuels in the world. And those export-related emissions of coal and fossil gas in Australia are more than double its domestic emissions. Australia's domestic emissions have been falling since 2005, except the last couple of years, but its exports of coal and fossil gas have dramatically increased in Australia, or should I say both the Australian government and the Australian opposition parties both want to continue selling Australia's fossil fuels overseas to make money for Australia. That is a crazy situation where Australia is being impacted by climate change caused by global emissions, and yet Australia wants to sell more fossil fuels overseas to increase global emissions of carbon dioxide. It doesn't make sense to me, and I am strongly opposed to that. In my public statement, even yesterday I was on the radio talking about that craziness, and it will be the case. Australia has a national election later this year. The date has not yet been set, but there will be an Australian election, and it is unclear what would be the policy on exports of fossil fuels from Australia. Both parties at present support that action.
Welcome to Canada. We're exactly the same. We talk a good climate game at times, but in fact, we're just accelerating our exports of LNG. A new port is opening up this spring to export it. And of course, we're talking about opening new coal mines in Alberta, if you can believe that. And the tar sands are pumping out more than ever. So we've got the same big problem right here in Canada, and I think in any fossil fuel producing country, we have to include Norway. We have to, you know, everybody's going to have to look in the mirror and see where their products are going. From Melbourne, Australia, we've been speaking with eminent scientist Dr. David Karoly. He is the author of over 250 scientific publications, and he's been a government advisor. You can find links to follow up on the news and science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for spending time with our listeners in Australia and around the world.
You're most welcome and happy to do it. Maybe we can reduce the frequency of your discussions with me from once every decade or so to maybe once every few years. And the one topic we didn't touch on is nuclear power in Australia or not. It is an issue that the opposition party in Australia is pushing very, very hard on to achieve net zero emissions in Australia by 2050, says it all we need to do is to switch to nuclear power. And that is a recipe for all sorts of problems, and I'm happy to talk about it, but I am very strongly opposed to it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.